Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Hey, robot, want a job? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You've heard of outsourcing. Well, now some jobs are coming back to the U.S. Problem is, they're being filled by machines, and it's not just call center jobs.
I am a writer, and there are actually pretty capable machines now doing writing.
Also, a massive wildfire continues to burn in Western Canada.
It may be months, maybe years before things get back to normal in Fort McMurray.
And the NYPD challenges Scotland's cops to do a dance in public and film it.
Why not? We love a dance up here in Scotland. Filming it in Edinburgh in front of the castle would be a perfect opportunity.
And that's how a move called The Running Man got done in a kilt. The stories today on The World. Thank you for being here on this Friday. How many times in this campaign season have we heard angry words from candidates about outsourced jobs? And it's not just Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders talking about American jobs going overseas. This is a major source of anxiety for many Americans. But what if I told you that some of those jobs may be coming back? That would be a good thing. Sort of, because some of the new jobs coming back to the U.S. are not being filled by humans, but by machines. That's where our first guest comes in. Julia Kirby is a co-author of Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines.
Well, the set of jobs that people are really interested in talking about right now are all the so-called knowledge work jobs. Things like call centers can be set up in India or the Philippines or anywhere offshore. And there's a huge labor cost advantage in doing that. Those are the jobs that we're now talking about being automated, and therefore, you know, I don't know if you would say they're coming back, but they'll no longer be offshored. They're sort of going to be no-shored.
Right. So, but have you seen this trend start, that some of these jobs are coming back in the form of automation or some kind of robotic?
So the way that the jobs are coming back, I mean, you might not say the same job is coming back. Now that those processes are being turned over to smart machines, we now need this kind of next level of knowledge worker job, this sort of data scientists and the people who build the machines. And those, I guess we could say, those jobs are coming back. It's, in a way, they're being created. But there are some jobs that are going to fill in for the ones that have been lost.
So break it down for us, because you wrote the book, In the Age of Smart Machines, Who Will the Losers Be?
Who will the losers be? Well, the losers, I think, will be people who are trying to outdo the machines at what machines are good at and aren't really capable of doing that. Of course, there's always going to be some tiny fraction of us who can outthink a machine.
Can you give me an example?
For instance, right now in financial advising, you have robo-advisors that have been introduced. This is a really complex computational task to figure out, for instance, you have a retirement savings account, how should it be allocated? So asset allocation, very complicated task. People go to school for a long time to learn to do that. There's no way you can do that today better than a computer can do it. We talked to...
Really?
No, that's absolutely true. What you can do is all the hand-holding that goes along with that, because a lot of times the client may not be willing to, you know, buy when the price is low, or they might be, you know, unwilling to put away enough as a young person. You're dealing with human people as clients, so yes, there's always a strong need for humanity in the interface, we could say.
So as far as winners, I mean, I guess the cold weather of Alaska would make it a great place to set up massive server farms that need to stay cool, but that's not going to employ a lot of people. Aside from Alaska, who might win in this whole game?
The winners are going to be the folks who figure out how they're going to recast their relationship with, you know, these smart machines, which absolutely are going to invade their workplaces.
Yeah.
So we are now going to all be working with computers that don't simply support our decisions, but are able to make decisions and make them better than we are.
Julia, in your own work, how often do you find yourself looking over your shoulder at the machine bearing down on you? I mean, what do you do to avoid being replaced?
Well, it's funny you would say that. You know, so I am a writer, and there are actually pretty capable machines now doing writing. But the type of writing that they're doing, I mean, I think you and I probably wouldn't covet. So they're, for instance,
right. doing... Pretty dry.
Well, and but to tell you the truth, some of it is not so dry in the execution. You know, sometimes you can't even tell the difference. So do I worry? Well, at the moment, no. But, you know, with Moore's Law behind this stuff, how quickly could it take on some of these purely human tasks?
Julia Kirby is the author of Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. Thanks very much for your time.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
So figure out how to stay human. If you're a techie in Bangalore, India, though, you may not be looking over your shoulder quite yet. A recent study suggests that by 2020, Bangalore will be the single largest IT cluster on the planet. 2 million IT professionals, 6 million indirect IT jobs, and $80 billion in exports. Bigger than Silicon Valley, really. My colleague Mary Kay Magstad was recently in Bangalore. Mary Kay explores the big issues and dynamics driving change in the 21st century on her podcast, Whose Century Is It? Hey, Mary Kay.
Hi, Marco.
So what got you interested in Bangalore?
Well, I've been interested in India for a long time, but what got me interested most recently was I was at a tech conference in San Francisco last fall. And this is a conference that's sponsored by a group of Chinese entrepreneurs. It tends to be a little self-congratulatory, talking about China's innovation and China's inevitable rise. And there was one afternoon session where there was a Harvard Business School educated Indian official. This is what he had to say.
Gentlemen, I'm here to take you on a small journey to tell you why Silicon Valley is about to be Bangalore and disrupted.
Okay, prepare to be Bangalore. Did the organizers of that conference know what they were getting into when he stepped in the room?
I'm not sure they entirely did. So this is Srivatsa Krishna, who is very well-spoken, very charismatic, and, you know, has a little swagger when he's giving his pitch. And you could see that some of the people in the audience, particularly the Chinese nationals, got a little on edge as they listened to him give his pitch. And afterward, as they were asking questions, there was a lot of challenging him on, you know, how is it possible that India could be a challenge even to China, much less to Silicon Valley? I mean, you have bad infrastructure. You guys produce a lot of fakes, which I thought was kind of rich because China is known for doing that too. Mm. You know, your universities aren't well integrated in terms of promoting innovation. He said, yeah. But despite all that, we're still doing this. And we've still got, you know, the population of Bangalore has doubled in the last 15 years. A lot of the people who are coming in are young, educated entrepreneurs and professionals who are really excited about what's happening there.
So you heard this appeal about how great Bangalore is and it's going to be better. And you go there, right?
Right. So at the end of his pitch, Srivatsa says, you know, and I invite you all to come, any of you who are interested to come and see what's happening on the ground in Bangalore. So I thought, sure, why not? I went, talked to him, went around Bangalore, went to something called the Startup Warehouse, which is part of a national initiative to encourage at least 10,000 startups in India over the course of 10 years. Now, over the first 3 years this has been going, there have been more than 12,000 startups. And the people who are involved say, yeah, that's great. But, you know, we're looking for 10,000 successful startups. So, you know, we're still pushing. We still want to move this forward. I also went to a Bangalore Bio Innovation Center, where there are some cutting edge companies that are working on especially issues that affect the poorest people in India, the most vulnerable, like how to make wounds heal faster, how to deal with allergens, and also how to predict whether someone's going to have an epileptic seizure.
So did you see what Srivatsa Krishna was talking about at that conference? Did you see how Bangalore could Bangalore the rest of the world?
Well, look, even he said Silicon Valley is going to remain sort of the world-class center of innovation for a long time to come. But it was interesting to me that some of the entrepreneurs I spoke to who were educated in the U.S., who had worked for Western companies, including in Silicon Valley. There's one guy who had a company that he started that had been acquired by Yahoo, and he's now living in Silicon Valley. He said, look, I'm going to move back to Bangalore because that's where the energy is. That's where the opportunity is. And in fact, when I'm talking to investors in Silicon Valley, they're saying, well, you know, are you going to be active in India and or China? And if you're not, they're not so interested. You know, when I was there, the energy there reminded me of how China felt 10 years ago. And it's not coincidental that that's the case, because in fact, in India right now, half the population is under age 25. India is coming into its own demographic dividend. What China had for 30 years, the past 30 years, as its economy was growing, you know, basically an outsized generation moving through the workforce. Now that generation in China is aging and China's workforce is contracting, and India's workforce is just getting going. And these are digital natives.
Mary Kay, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
That's Mary Kay Magstad in San Francisco. You can hear much more about Bangalore and the people Mary Kay met there in today's episode of her podcast, Whose Century Is It? At PRI.org. The title pretty much says it all, Prepare to be Bangalored. My city of Cambridge, Massachusetts has just over 100,000 people, and I keep that in mind when thinking about Fort McMurray in Alberta, Canada, with around 88,000 people now all evacuated. That's because of the massive wildfire there. It continues to rage out of control. Neil Scott is one of the evacuees.
Coming out of Fort McMurray, there was fire on the hillside. I could feel the heat through my car. The flames were 10 or 15 feet from my vehicle.
Efforts to control the fire have been foiled by high winds, and Alberta is now in crisis mode. But this fire is actually part of a longer-term pattern. In the last 40 years, the area burned by wildfires in Canada has doubled. That's due to climate change, says Mike Flanagan. He's a wildfire expert at the University of Alberta.
The warmer it gets, the more fire we see. And people ask me all the time, well, why is temperature so important? And there's three reasons. First, the warmer we get, the longer our fire season is. Second, the warmer it gets, the more lightning we have. The more lightning we have, the more ignitions we have. Third, as we warm, the atmosphere's ability to hold moisture increases almost exponentially. It's like the atmosphere gets more efficient at sucking the moisture out of the fuel. So it's easier for the fuels to catch fire and to spread fire.
So the connection to climate change, the flow chart would look kind of like climate change starts it, weather change then results, and then there's a greater risk of fire. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. We're seeing more frequent intense fires. And then we have people now more than ever living, working, playing in the boreal forest. So we have this intersection between people and fire, and sometimes with devastating effects.
And when trees burn, that also releases more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Could this fire in Alberta end up contributing to global warming?
In a way, yes. Greenhouse gases are produced through the combustion process. I think it's more from peat. And there's a lot of peatlands in Alberta. And there's been studies of Indonesia peat fires that suggest the emissions from peat fires in Indonesia were equivalent to 20 to 40% of global fossil fuel emissions. Now, keep in mind that the peat in the boreal forest is 30 times more than Indonesia. So the warmer we get, the more fires we get, the more fires we get, the more greenhouse gases we get, which makes it even warmer.
So you were telling me earlier, Mike, that the effects of the Fort McMurray, Alberta fires are now being detected in the Gulf of Mexico. You're in Edmonton, the capital of Alberta. What's the effect on life there?
Well, there's over 80,000 evacuees. I'm expecting that we'll see 20 to 30,000 evacuees here. Some of the kids are already going to school here because it may be months, maybe years before things get back to normal in Fort McMurray. I'd like to mention briefly that there was a pyrocumulonimbus generated from this fire.
That's a massive like fire cloud?
It's a massive fire thunderstorm.
Oh my God, that sounds like apocalyptic.
It does. Well, I've just found out recently that this pyrocumulus generated lightning started new fires because the fuels are so dry. So we've got the fire generating more fires.
Mike Flanagan directs the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta. Thanks for your time, Mike. We're thinking of you guys.
Okay, thanks, Marco.
You're with the world. There is a lot going on in British politics. London got a new mayor today. And then in about a month, voters will decide whether Britain stays in the European Union or exits, the so-called Brexit. Big important vote, but a group of young women in London felt that the discussion surrounding the Brexit vote was too boring and that younger voices were being left out. So they came up with a campaign to change that. It's called We Are Europe, and Bethan Harris is one of its founders. She told me it all started about 8 weeks ago.
Me and about three friends at the time were sort of texting about this. basically just kind of was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Somebody's got to do something about this. If we're not engaged and we're usually more socially active than our friends, then no one's going to be engaged at all. Mm. But it was going to end there, really. Like we weren't thinking at the time, hey, we need to start a political campaign. And so at that point, you know, we were just bouncing ideas around. And I sent one of the girls a message and said, would you wear I Am European on a T-shirt? And from there, We Are Europe was born.
So lay it out for us. Why do you feel that it's best for the UK to stay in Europe, in the EU?
Most people that you'd ask that question to right now in the UK wouldn't be able to tell you the answer. And I don't think 8 weeks ago I would have had a clue what the answer was. And I don't feel it's right for me to tell people, like, you know, all the reasons why they should stay in. For us, it's about understanding what the EU means for the things that we as a generation are passionate about and care about.
Things like what?
Yeah, so for me, a big part of it was the freedom of movement across the EU. So when I was 16, I was very, very lucky to go to Eastern Europe with a bunch of other young Europeans, all 16. And on the first night of our get-together, there were 30 16-year-olds from across Europe. The guy running this course asked us to put our hand up if we wanted to live and work in another country one day. And everyone put their hand up, like, who isn't going to do that if you're 16? You're going to want to live and work in another country one day. And then he asked us to keep our hands up if we thought we could live and work in another country one day. And at that point, I think about six of us kept our hands up out of 30. And those six of us were from Western Europe. And the rest of the people who left their hands down are from Eastern Europe. And they were, at that time, weren't part of the European Union. And so not only for them was it kind of completely impossible to think that they would be able to live and work somewhere else one day, they were telling us that for them to go to see their favourite band play in a concert, they would have to get two different visas to be able to travel from where they were to where the concert would be, because the bands didn't come to them and they couldn't fly because there weren't direct cheap flights, so they'd have to get trains, so they'd have to go through two borders. This could be a possibility. This could be actually a real thing. Like, we could wake up on June 24th, the day after the referendum, and wake up and realise that we might be leaving the EU. That memory just came back to me all of a sudden, and I was like, why on earth would we deny ourselves the rights that we have, these amazing freedoms and amazing rights that we have, and deny our children? And, you know, I was thinking about the group of 30 that were there when I was 16. Most of them now live and work in other countries because of the EU.
You've described the Brexit debate as men in grey suits. Do you feel that you could recharacterize that now that you've started this campaign?
Yeah, we were founded by four young women. So we've already changed the face of campaigning through that.
And presumably you're not in grey suits.
We're not in grey suits. No, absolutely not.
Bethan Harris, one of the founders of the We Are Europe campaign in the UK, which is aiming to keep the UK from leaving the EU. That referendum comes up on June 23rd. Bethan, thanks very much for being with us.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Musicians from across Europe will gather in Sweden next week for the finals of the Eurovision Song Contest. It's usually a showcase of positive, feel-good tunes. Think ABBA. But this year's Ukraine's entry has sparked controversy and protests from Russia. It's a song by the Crimean Tatar singer Jamala. It recounts how Soviet forces forcibly deported Tatars from Crimea during World War II. Jamala's family was part of that. Dave Stern caught up with the singer in Kiev.
Jamala says her song, 1944, is more than her first entry in the Eurovision Song Contest finals. For her, it's an intensely personal composition that tells the painful story of her family and the Crimean Tatars.
When strangers are coming, they come to your house.
In May 1944, Soviet authorities accused the Crimean Tatars of collaborating with Nazi Germany. They were forced into cattle cars and transported thousands of miles away to Soviet Central Asia. According to estimates, as many as half of those deported died en route or immediately afterwards. Jamala says among the dead was her great-grandmother's infant. I spoke with Jamala in a cafe in Kiev.
My great-grandmother held a baby in her arms, a girl 1.5 years old. She died along the way, and my great-grandmother asked a Soviet soldier to bury her. But the soldier just opened the wagon door and threw the body out. And there were thousands of cases like this.
Jamala was born Susanna Jamaladinova in Kyrgyzstan. Only when the Soviet Union broke up could Tatars freely return to Crimea, which was by then a part of an independent Ukraine. But for Jamala, the date 1944 still resonated.
Because every fragment of our family histories came from what was passed down from the deportation. I wrote this song most likely to free my soul, to free my heart, because the stone that lay on my chest for all of my 32 years was so heavy that I had to write about what happened.
But it's not just about what happened in 1944. Many of our Ukrainian fans view it as a protest song, an expression of their rage over Russia's annexation of Crimea 2 years ago. For Crimean Tatars who've suffered in Russia-controlled Crimea, it's even more pointed. But Eurovision songs aren't supposed to be political. And Russian officials say the song violates Eurovision rules. Some of them have called for a boycott of the competition. Jamala insists there's nothing political about her song. It's just a story about her family.
There is nothing in it that could insult any individual or country. Nothing is directed against anyone. Sure, there is a date, but this is a date that's important to my family.
Apparently, the Eurovision organizers agree. So when the Eurovision competitors gather later this month, the story of the Crimean Tatars and Jamala's family will be front and center. For The World, David Stern, Kiev.
Ukraine's entry in Eurovision there, Jamala. News headlines are coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A galactic battle is brewing over the Klingon language, but the lawyers can't even get to hello, let alone yes, in Klingon.
There is no word for hello, because what's the point of hello? In Klingon, the closest thing to that would be, what do you want?
So a no-nonsense kind of language. That story coming up later here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You probably know Palo Alto, California, as a part of Silicon Valley and the home of Stanford University and Facebook. But recently, Palo Alto has become known for something else, a cluster of teen suicides. This, sadly, is something that has happened in many communities across the U.S. But I asked reporter Grace Huang Lynch if there's something different about Palo Alto. Grace has been following the story for our Global Nation desk.
I think the thing that struck people is that in a course of a really short amount of time, there's been a lot of teen suicides, so much that the rate here in Palo Alto is 4 or 5 times higher than the national average. And we're not seeing the kind of indicators for suicide that you might see in other places, such as kids being bullied or anything like that. These are kids who appear on the outside to have everything together.
Is there an explanation for why this is happening?
It's really unclear, which is why The county health department in this area invited the CDC out in February to try to figure out what's going on here.
We were interested in this story partly because Palo Alto has such a large Asian American community. How much are Asian families affected by this trend?
This area here in Silicon Valley and in Palo Alto in particular is about 40% Asian American. And when you look at the statistics of the youth who've committed suicide over the past 7 years, the statistics are also bearing out to show that about 40% of the kids who've committed suicide are also Asian American.
Yeah. So what does that tell us? Simply that the population in the schools tracks the same ratio of kids trying to kill themselves?
You know, there's a couple of interesting things here. One of the psychiatrists I spoke with, her name is Dr. Rona Hu, and she works with Stanford University. She said, whereas it's not because of culture, everything isn't because of culture, but you can't neglect the impact that culture may have. So are the same methods that people are using to talk to parents and to talk to teenagers about depression and mental health, should we be doing something different for Asian American students as opposed to white students?
Yeah, I know this is a hot issue in the schools there, and you looked into how the schools are trying to reach out to Asian American families. What did you find out?
What I hear from people over and over who are working in the community, in the schools, and with the parents is that a lot of these families are fairly recent immigrants from China, Korea, Taiwan, or different countries. There's a different expectation put on academics. Their stakes in their academic career are much higher, and they're much more based on, you know, academic achievement, even down to like a single test. And then there's the different communication styles. If you're assuming that everybody parents the way that European-based American family would parent, then you're not even really starting in the right place.
You know, I'm reluctant, Grace, to call up cultural stereotypes about tiger moms or overachieving kids, stuff like that. But I do wonder whether any of that well-publicized intense drive to succeed is behind any of this, or is it getting in the way of understanding what's going on?
One of the factors that the psychiatrist pointed out is that because of this very pervasive image of the tiger parent, there's a little bit of tension in the community here. Maybe you hear people saying things at school board meetings, or anytime there's an article posted in the local newspaper, you see the comments start to insinuate things about Asian immigrant tiger mothers pushing their kids too hard and creating this culture. But, you know, at the same time, that also makes it hard for real discussions to happen, because then those parents end up feeling vilified, and then they sort of withdraw from engaging in these conversations. You know, they do have good intentions. It's just that maybe they're operating from a different expectation. You know, they're expecting their kids to have to do certain things. One of the quotes that I found really interesting was from a school psychologist who said, a principal told her, before it used to be you had parents coming in and having really high expectations, but perhaps that parent came into the school and said, why did my kid not make the football team? So it was a really good analogy of showing that parental expectations are there in a lot of different cultures. They may take different specific forms, but, you know, it's a way to relate it to more people.
So what happens from here? I know the Centers for Disease Control are conducting a study. Any early indications of what they might recommend?
Their report is expected to come out in a few months. And from the mental health practitioners that I've spoken to in this area, really, it's kind of out of their hands. It's kind of been turned over to the federal investigation, and everybody wants to know what the answers are.
Grace Huang Lynch speaking with me from Palo Alto, California. You can read her Global Nation story at PRI.org. Grace, good to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
North Korea's got this reputation as the Hermit Kingdom. Still, several Western journalists were invited to Pyongyang this week to observe the Communist Party Congress there. Not that they've been allowed to see much of anything, but there are places where folks can chat, sing, and even hold hands with North Koreans. I'm talking about restaurants outside of North Korea that funnel cash to the government back home. From Bangkok, the world's Patrick Nguyen has our story.
It's a bit surreal hearing North Koreans sing Country Roads, Take Me Home. But these aren't average North Koreans. They're an all-female brigade of singing waitresses, each handpicked and trained by the world's most tyrannical regime, which has taught them to sing John Denver and the Beatles. These women are deployed to dozens of restaurants across Asia, from Bangkok to Saigon.
It is an easy way to get a taste of this bizarre, very strange culture that is North Korea. So people are drawn to it.
That's Sung Yoon Lee, a North Korea expert at Tufts University. He says these restaurants make millions. It goes directly back to Pyongyang, which desperately needs the cash.
The waitresses are closely vetted by the state. They are highly trained. They are people who would be very competitive music students at a leading conservatory in Boston or New York.
They're also trained to be charming.
They very naturally get the customers one by one to come up and twist and twirl around, dance a little bit with them. And I have a feeling that everything's videotaped.
Oh, there is surveillance going on inside these restaurants.
I would be stunned if North Korean restaurants were not bugged.
In Bangkok, I actually witnessed an American guy in his 40s waltzing with a North Korean hostess. No idea he might be videotaped. Really, a little espionage isn't so shocking. After all,
North Korea is the most perfect totalitarian state that the world has ever seen.
So eating at a North Korean state restaurant is ethically dicey. Not only do the franchises fund a repressive state, but the waitresses have very little freedom.
The restaurants are closely watched because these young, quite attractive waitresses could very easily defect.
In fact, Pyongyang is reeling from one of its most embarrassing defection cases ever. Last month, 12 waitresses at a restaurant in China just walked out. Across Asia, North Korean restaurants are suddenly closing without explanation. But I do find one in Thailand that's still open.
Hello.
The place is quiet. Most of the staff are gone, and the singing and dancing, canceled. I sit down and order some food.
One of the boiled pork head.
The waitress is perfectly poised, wearing a silk dress and a smile. I start to talk to her, but she's clearly uncomfortable.
Do you ever use Facebook?
No, she says. The internet is a frivolous place. Well, do you like American songs? No, she says. True patriots do not need to look outside their culture.
Can I ask another question? Do you miss home?
Miss home? Well, this restaurant, she says, it's like an extension of North Korea. I can clearly see I'm making her nervous, and I start to feel guilty. She whispers something to her manager and then vanishes into the back. So I decide to just out myself and ask the manager for a real interview.
So you mean you want an interview, right?
Yes, interview.
You don't accept it.
No interviews?
Yes.
Oh, why not?
It's our rights and our freedom. Why do we have to join the interview?
We don't give interviews, he says. The U.S. media lies too much. What's more, he says, you're rude. You ask political questions. Questions about how the government trains women to sing. He says, that's politics, isn't it?
I don't mean the trouble. Is it something that we have a reason? That's why we don't want to answer.
He's getting agitated. His jaw is noticeably quivering. I kind of feel bad again, pressing him like this. But I tell him, look, talking about Facebook, music, these are normal topics people would discuss with friends. And that's when he laughs at me.
We are not friends, right? We are just meet and the customer and this. Right?
We're not friends, he says. And of course, he's right. They may sing with us. They may twirl and dance with us, But that does not make us friends. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
When we talk about all the children from Central America being sent by their parents alone across hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles to get to the U.S. border, you have to ask why. Here's one explanation that takes us to El Salvador. El Salvador is facing a record wave of murders, 22 killings a day on average in the first 3 months of 2016. That makes the country one of the deadliest on earth. El Salvador's economy is in bad shape as well. But in the little town of Jucuapa, with just 18,000 people, the coffin-making business is booming. Reuters photographer Jose Cabezas documented this on a recent visit. Jose, thanks for being with us. The violence in El Salvador, it's not a new thing, sadly. Mm-hmm. What did you hope to achieve by telling the story of the coffin business in this little town?
Well, since about 2009, we have a big increase on homicides in El Salvador. So we were taking pictures all the time of crime scenes or violent scenes everywhere in the country. But we started to take some pictures or stories not directly related with violence, some stories with no blood in the pictures.
I gather a couple of years ago there were only 3 coffin factories in Jucuapa. How many coffin factories are there now?
Now they have like 18 officially. It was a traditional business in Jucuapa, but not this big as it is today.
So it's really grown. What was happening in Jucuapa before the coffin business?
Actually, Jucuapa was full of farms, coffee growers, and cattle, but not anymore. I mean, a lot of people is leaving the town, or agricultural is not a good business for them anymore. So they found a way to survive in their hometown.
Do the workers in the coffin factory kind of reflect on the fact that they are employed because of all this violence?
Yes, they never say it openly, but they know the business is good because of the homicide wave in the country, especially because they are exporting their product to Honduras and Guatemala, which are very violent countries also. They are conscious about it.
You went to Jucuapa as a stranger, Jose. I mean, people didn't know you. Were you safe? Did you feel safe? And did you have any trouble getting the trust of your subjects?
Kind of. My mother is from the area, but I never have been in Jucuapa before. So we were in the street and we saw a pickup truck full of coffins in the back. So I started to take pictures of the pickup truck, and the owner tried to not be photographed. And we started to talk about, was doing a story about the town and the coffin factories and everything. And he was very nice, not in the beginning, but he was very nice. But this guy introduced us to other owners.
I mean, and you're lucky, because suppose that guy was a gang member.
I was very, very lucky, because, I mean, there is ways to be safe in this country. The problem was with the workers. Some of them, they wanted to be photographed. They were very natural. But in some cases, they say, no, I mean, I don't want to be photographed. I don't want to be recognized. To see them in a publication like a newspaper or even in the internet, and gang members can see them. I don't know. I mean, I don't even ask about it. I just say, okay, not a problem. I point my camera in some other way, but I didn't have any problems. But, you know, I was lucky. To tell you the truth, I was really lucky.
Reuters photographer Jose Cabezas speaking with me from El Salvador. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can see all of Jose's photos from Jucuapa. They're up at PRI.org. Someone once said that players in Hollywood act like the Sicilian mob and talk like hippies, but I still don't understand what this means.
Go back!
That's what Paramount Pictures is saying this week. Apparently, no in Klingon.
Go back! And as always in Klingon, speak with authority and get right to the matter.
Authority over the fictional Star Trek language of Klingon is what Paramount is claiming. This past week, Klingon became the center of a legal dispute between Paramount, which owns the rights to Star Trek, and Axanar Productions, a company seeking to make a Klingon-inspired film. Paramount claims their copyright of Star Trek includes the language. Enter First Amendment lawyer Mark Randazza.
The only time I've ever been to a Star Trek convention was in 1988, and I was walking through Copley Square in Boston, tripping on acid, and I noticed there were all these people around with that looked like they were from Star Trek, and I figured I was the only one that could see it. And then I bumped straight into Scotty.
And he probably said to Scotty, beam me up, and fast. Anyway, Rondazza filed an amicus brief on behalf of the Language Creation Society. The brief went viral. Klingon is a language, he claimed in the brief, and languages cannot be copyrighted. To drive the point home, he even wrote bits of the brief in Klingon, but not too well.
As soon as people started criticizing my Klingon grammar and what a real Klingon would say at a time like this and a time like that, you know, if there's a dispute over how to say intellectual property law in Klingon, then it's a living language.
Rondazza thinks this concept of a living language is key to proving why Paramount cannot copyright Klingon. And by the way, Klingon is not the only language invented for Hollywood that's been copyrighted.
Adorfinan Kal Nevesoe Je Kalisi.
That's Dothraki, the Game of Thrones language. HBO claims to have copyrighted Dothraki, but can they really?
That's the real question here, right? Can you copyright Dothraki? You can copyright the Dothraki lines in Game of Thrones, but the moment that two people sit down and have a conversation in Dothraki, and that's the way that they communicate, I think you have lost that control.
Klingon may have spiraled far out of the reaches of Paramount's control since it was invented in 1984. Today, there are Klingon language courses, a Klingon language institute, a Klingon dictionary. Shakespearean plays have been translated and performed in Klingon. And this is part of what Rondazza thinks is at stake with this lawsuit, the ability to continue to create original work in Klingon. One thing Klingon is not good for, however, is ending a conversation, at least not politely.
There is no thank you. All you would do is when you're finished, you would just hang up. And that would be my sign that you have no more use for me.
Politeness aside, the Klingon case is still pending, and a decision is expected within the month. Finally today, let's get up and running and dancing. That combo is what's known as the running man, and some police departments around the globe are using it as a recruitment tool. It started with police in New Zealand, who then challenged their counterparts in New York City, and then the NYPD challenged the police in Scotland to do the hashtag running man challenge, and of course, it all ends up online. Gemma Crolla is one of the Scottish police officers in the latest video, shot in front of Edinburgh Castle.
Why not? We love a dance up here in Scotland. We got nominated by NYPD. Police Scotland were nominated. And I think we all sort of agreed that filming it in Edinburgh in front of the castle would be perfect.
Yeah, so explain how this all worked. You got nominated. Does that mean the NYPD knew you guys had something to offer?
Well, it was on the back of the New Zealand police recruitment video. So they sort of started the ball rolling. They were sort of the original pranksters with their first video. And they, kind of similar to the Ice Bucket Challenge, just like sort of nominating another person, another organisation. So New Zealand nominated NYPD to respond. And NYPD, I think we all sort of follow each other on social media, different police forces around the world. And they picked ourselves and Boston and I think New York Fire Service as well to sort of respond to the challenge. So we weren't ones to shy away from that.
Wow. So what's the elimination process? Who's going to win this thing?
Well, I think the public probably decide that. We've had over, I think, 1.2 million views on our Edinburgh page. But
wow, nice.
It's been really successful and we've had some really positive feedback from it. So it's good. It's good fun.
Do you think you're a good dancer?
I'll let other people decide on that one. Oh,
the point is you're having fun, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're definitely not ones to shy away from a dance.
So describe the choreography for us, because I'm sure the NYPD was thinking, we don't really need bagpipes for it, but you provided them.
We did, yeah. Choreography is probably, I mean, you're probably using that word in the loosest sense.
I'm being a little generous.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, it was a matter of trying to respond as quickly as we could to sort of keep it fresh, keep up the momentum and, you know, getting five or six officers together, who some of whom hadn't even met each other before, and getting together and trying to cobble something together up at the castle. It was a tough challenge, but it was a lot of fun. And we approached a local piper as well, who kindly accepted the challenge as well. So we all sort of got together and, well, you've seen the final product, so what are your thoughts?
It's beautiful, you know. Anybody who dances means they've got a song in their heart, so that's a good thing.
I agree.
I got to say, anyone who's seen the Spike Lee movie Do the Right Thing remembers that opening credit sequence with Rosie Perez dancing her butt off. We'll see the kind of foundational footwork of Running Man. Is there a trick to this running in place dance, doing it right?
I think you've just got to go with the song in your heart, as you put it. It's a case of embracing the moment. And it was New Zealand that started it. They probably want to show the human side of policing, much like ourselves. And, you know, we do a really serious job on a daily basis. And it's nice to show the public that we've got a bit of a fun side too. Do you know what? We got some great cheers and quite a bit of an audience on the castle on the day, which I think helped. So, yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, so what's the end game here? Get every police department in the world dancing.
That would be amazing. I think that should be our goal. Yeah, absolutely.
Gemma Crolla, a police officer in Edinburgh. Keep on dancing.
Thanks. Cheers then.
Okay, I know I pegged the start date of The Running Man to Rosie Perez and Do the Right Thing. I've already been informed that Janet Jackson did it before that. But even before that, there was this dancer in Fela Kuti's band, Fela being the late great Nigerian king of Afrobeat. Back in 1978, at a live show in Berlin, she seemed to be doing The Running Man. See for yourself, I found the video on YouTube from that gig. Dancing, music, and all. And that's our show today. I challenge you to dance this weekend. Running Man, Lindy Hop, freestyle, whatever. If you need some inspiration, you can watch me and a few others here in the newsroom try our own hand and feet at the Running Man Challenge. Just look for The World on Instagram. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nana Bill Harris Studios. Here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.